We should record, fellas, the process you have to go through with me just before we go on air. Okay? To remind me of what's going on. Warren and I talk all the time. Warren produces the show and writes it and scripts it. And we talk, you know, beforehand. And I said, Warren, I got your notes. I don't think we need to talk. He said, Jim, we need to talk. To make sure you get it right. How are you doing, Kevin? How was the week? Were you out golfing again?
A little bit of golf. Yeah. And Jim, you know, we have really hit summertime here in Alberta. We're around 28 today, going up 31, 32, 34, 33 over the next few days. So yes, get the golf clubs out and get in the sunshine.
Hey, Warren, you're a golf guy. We almost had a Canadian bust through in the U.S. Open. Mackenzie Hughes tied for the lead. So many curlers are good golfers, and you play. Did you watch it?
Oh, you bet I did. That was a very interesting finish. Kind of interesting was to watch DeChambeau implode, which we can all relate to as golfers that that happens, and it happens to the best of them.
Who's the best golfer you know, Kevin, as a curler?
Whoa, oh, geez. Wayne Madaw's got to be up there, definitely. But there's a lot of good curlers that are good golfers. Quite a few. BJ as well, Neufeld off of the Cooey team. He's a terrific golfer. And Benny Hebes, I thinks he's the best golfer.
But yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You got to always have fun with Benny.
Summertime curlers turn to golf, but we don't. We stay on curling. Let's roll out another show, fellas.
Last rock, eighth end, up by two.
Should be all there. I don't think I'm white.
I don't think you are either.
Oh.
It's clean. Don't kill it, Ben.
Line's really good. Line's good. Right on the button, guys. Right
here. Last stone for Kevin Martin. They want it on the button. The sweepers are watching it. Fans are on their feet. Kevin Martin goes out as a champion. Cuts him to one. He will win his final Grand Slam, taking the Players' Championship. Talk about putting an exclamation mark at the end of a career. All he had to do was cut him down. Kevin Martin can celebrate. He is a champion.
Okay, boys. The curling world goes on, and there's our Facebook page is crazy active with it. Warren, you're going to talk about some of that. Last week on the show, we discussed an email from Kyler Kleibrink where we talked about burned stones. There was some confusion there for some people, and Warren, you're going to clear that up for us about some of that confusion. We also talked about making games a mandatory eight ends at the high-performance level. Again, there was a huge amount of discussion about that. Meaning you got to play at least eight. Some guys are walking off before then. And it wasn't one-sided, Warren, that discussion about that. We've got a bunch of emails, and we'll try and get to some of those. Also, great guest that we have coming on. Erin Flowers is the president of Goldline, and she's undertaken a program called United We Curl about diversity in curling and creating awareness in the sport of curling. And it's very interesting. I was reading some stuff about what their company has put out and a statement that they've made about it and an initiative that they've undertaken. And we're going to talk to her. Our email address, and we'd love to get them, insidecurling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter. You can follow us at Curling Inside, Facebook at Inside Curling, and our Instagram is at Inside Curling Podcast. Thanks a lot, everyone, to your emails. Keep sending them. We'd love to read them. Let's get rolling. Warren, you're going to start with this. Last week on the show, we discussed an email from Kyler Kleibrink, where we talked about burning running stones. Lots of discussion on the Facebook group about this, and a few people are getting a burned moving stone confused with a touched stationary stone. Straighten us out, Warren, about all that.
Yes, to a very large degree, those are two very different situations. And I guess we need to make it clear that if you touch a stationary rock, you must automatically put it back to the satisfaction of the opponent. And so that means if you move a stone where there could be a measurement in question about who shot rock, you have to put it back to the opponent's favor. And that's not been always clearly understood through time. A couple of things related historically in the Facebook group. One was the Orris Melischuk situation way back in 1972 that virtually cost the American skip Bob Lamonti a world championship. And that was a situation where Melischek threw his last rock. He hit, he rolled, the rock stopped. Immediate indication was that he had rolled too far. But the Canadian third, Dave Romano, was just looking at the two stones when Labonte jumped in the air thinking he'd won, slipped and kicked the one rock in question, which was their stone. And as a result, what should have automatically happened right away was the fact that the Canadian should have automatically been awarded the point. But the confusion that took place afterwards, Labonte was asked, did I kick the stone? Did you kick the stone? For whatever reason, he said no. And then they measured this rock that had been kicked. So it was a complete wrong application. And I believe another one of our Facebook followers, Shirley Morash, former president of the Canadian Curling Association, indicated a situation with Kevin Cooey going back in 1994 that was somewhat similar when an extra end, his second, and I believe it was the second, the rock was rolling and it looked like it was going to probably be the shot stone, but it was still moving and he couldn't get out of the way and he hit it. And again, it was a situation, the rock was almost stopped, but it wasn't. But the fact still remains, in any of those situations, when you touch a stone and it's anywhere in question as to who was shot between two stones, automatically you've got to concede it to the opposition, because this is something that all curlers need to remember. At the end of every end, people get careless. And you should never start kicking rocks until the opposing third has agreed with the third in your team as to what the score was in that end and who scored the points. Because otherwise, some horrendous things can take place. And I experienced back in my playing days a couple of situations where somebody kicked what you thought was an obvious situation, and the other team said, wait a minute, I wanted to measure that. So you've always got to be sure, because if you do that, you will automatically forfeit whatever points are involved.
Warren, what happens? I fire my rock, release the rock, and my sweepers touch it. Do you have to, do you stop the stone right away? Or
yes. What? Yeah, the way the rule is right now, a running stone and a stationary rock, again, two different situations.
Right.
Between the hog lines, and that would be if you touch it even when the person's released it before they get to the throwing hog line, you touch it in any way, shape, or form, you stop it right away. Once you get inside the second hog line, as we talked last week, it's a different set of rules, but up until that second hog line, touched stone, stopped right away.
Kev, I can imagine you've probably been in a situation where this has happened. Talk about take the fun out of the game if you're looking at that. Some, did you touch that stone? No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. You must have been in the throes of that somewhere, Kevin, in your career.
Yeah, the 92 Brier semifinal playing, of course, a great friend, the late Vic Peters in the semifinal. And Dan Petrick was sweeping a rock around a guard, so it was over the hog line, and falls. Actually, his broom broke. The handle broke. He was sweeping so hard, it broke the handle. So, of course, he went crashing down. But nothing seemed to change. The rock went around and dead buried just on the off side of the button. And anyway, so Dan said, I think I hit it. And I'm going, I didn't see anything change. And he said, yeah, but I'm sure. And I said, well, you know, Dan's a super honest guy. That was the ninth end of the Brier semifinal. So we took it off and then lost the game. And so we were out of it. And it was funny. So I'll get done. And are you sure Dan hit it? And I said, well, I saw nothing. And Dan said, I'm not positive I hit it, but I think I felt something on my back. So I had to take it off. So, okay. So we go in we couldn't find anything on the replays. So we actually went into the TV truck. And they actually went frame by frame. And sure enough, after Dan fell, the rock went further, which is impossible, per frame. So Dan did slightly touch the rock and sped it up, just a touch. And so we definitely made the right decision in pulling that stone in 1992. But that's exactly the thing. Like, did you hit it? I don't know. I'm not sure. And you know, but luckily, Dan felt he did. We pulled it because definitely in replays after, you would see the frame by frame, the rock, you know, increased in speed, which is impossible. So Dan obviously did touch it on his back and he made the right call, and that's fantastic.
Warren, it must have happened in your day, particularly back when you played, when guys were drinking till the game got more serious.
Oh, yes. We've all been involved in those situations where we've burned stones. And I was the sweeper next to the rock is usually the one that sometimes would get crowded by the front sweeper and would cause you to hit the stone. And, of course, this is as a sweeper in the sport of curling at the top level, this has got to be the number one thing in your mind in any critical situation. Don't burn the stone. And I know it was always in my mind.
We talked last week about making games a mandatory eight ends. There was someone brought up the fact that they don't like players walking off, Kev, when it looks like they got no shot, but they're mathematically not eliminated, but almost 99% sure they're not going to make it. So they call it a game. There was a huge amount of discussion on our Facebook. It seems there's some confusion between top high performance play and regular club play or Bonspiel play. Warren, what's going on with all this? What's happened this past week since we brought this up?
I found it rather interesting. I think there was something like 85 comments on this thing. And what I found very interesting about it was, again, the inability in this sport to separate the difference between the regular club or Bonspiel play and play at the high performance level or championship level. And it's a different situation. So in your curling club or your Bonspiel, if you want to have a situation where you can concede whenever you want or after four ends, no problem. That's there's no spectators involved. There's no television involved. And those are certainly rules of that competition. But what we were making the point of last week, at the high level, and I sort of look at it this way, if someone's paying money to watch a competition or if there's a television network involved where, again, there's money involved, I believe if the game is eight ends, it needs to be played eight ends until it is mathematically impossible for the other team to win. And I got into a back and forth with a couple of people. I said, let's compare it to match play in golf. If you're down six with six holes to play, do you concede the match? Because you're probably not going to win. No, you don't. And I think at the top level of the sport of curling where there's money involved, either people are paying to watch or there's a television network who's selling airtime around it, it needs to be whatever the regulation is. If it's eight ends, it needs to go eight ends or mathematical elimination or the same thing with 10. And so I think that's where we need to clarify the confusion. What happens at the club level or an area where there's nothing involved from a monetary point of view, from where spectators or television, it doesn't matter. But at the top level, I think it matters.
Yeah, this is one place where I think the game will change right away. And I don't have huge, strong feelings either way, other than for the fans. If they want to watch a certain person, and the curling game has changed. It used to be that the events where you paid and all the, you know, the big crowds would come to their 10-day events. And people would buy the $400 10-day package. And they would come and they would watch every game. It's not like that anymore. People are busy and they might go, okay, I can buy the Thursday afternoon and I've got enough time Saturday evening to go and have a glass of wine and watch a curling draw. So they don't make a lot of games. So if they're a big, doesn't matter who, Brendan Botcher fan, and they want to come watch, but they're only going to watch. They went Thursday afternoon. Unfortunately, Botcher wasn't playing. So they're going to get to watch Botcher one time Saturday night. Well, if they're a huge fan and all of a sudden they get down a bunch or up a bunch and that's it, five ends or four ends and it's done and everybody leaves the ice. Well, that's pretty disappointing for that fan that only had time to come to one or two draws. I was lucky enough to go to the 2001 Masters golf. And I was so excited, and there was a group, of course, the old guy group at the time, and that was Gary Player, Arnold Palmer, and Jack Nicklaus. Now, those three guys were, you know, older at that point. They're not going to win the tournament. They're not going to make the cut. But I followed them for quite a few holes, just getting to watch these legends of the sport. Absolutely loved it. I didn't care if they hit every shot good or made every putt. It didn't, don't matter. And, you know, and then, of course, all the different golfers, Greg Norman, another guy I loved. So, you know, I'd walk back, start on 18, walk backwards down the course, and then ran into the player Palmer, Nicklaus. Hope, turn around and follow them for a while. And then keep going, Greg Norman. Oh, gee, Greg, that's fantastic. I didn't even care what his score was. And I think that's a big point of it, is that it doesn't matter to a lot of fans, if they're a fan of the team, what the score is on the board. They're there to watch and cheer for and just, you know, just enjoy watching their favorite athlete do what they do. And in curling, you know, you've got these great athletes like a Rachel Holman and Jennifer Jones that people just love to watch, or an Anna Hasselborg, who's just huge now. These are the things I think that are important to fans. And I think that in curling, yes, when the game is mathematically over, I think you shut it down. If you're 9 down, if it's 10-1 going in the last end, you don't play the last end. That's silly. But if you're 7, you got to play it. I understand the odds of winning are very, very slim. I get it. But but it's not mathematically over, and we have to play those last ends.
What they got to come up with, you guys, is I understand what you're saying, Warren. Where, you know, we've got sponsors that we're responsible for, and we've got to be accountable to them. You know, they've bought 3-hour packages or something, but you get a bad game, you get a lopsided game, Warren. We've got to get to a stage where you can get out of that game, the one they're televising, and flip to another sheet of a game that's more competitive.
No question. Yes. If things are out of control, and in Sportsnet, Curtis Saville will come over to talk to us on the headphones and say, well, guys, this one's out of control. Which sheet do you think we should go to next? And then Joan will say, well, sheet B is actually a pretty good game. It looks like it's going good. So, okay. So we dive over there and do that game. But of course, that's on television. When it comes to the people in the building, the bums in the seats, there's particular teams they want to watch. And if they leave the ice, that's the end of it for them.
And also, you got to remember, we get down to playoff games and semifinals and finals. There's only one game on the ice often. And that's the total focus, 100%. And if that doesn't go the limit, you've got all kinds of issues. And I look at it from a player's point of view. They've got sponsors and they got names on their uniforms. And all of a sudden, it's an 8-hand game and you concede after 5 ends. You've taken yourself off television for 3 ends, which is detrimental to your own sponsors. So all in all, it's not the best decision from their point of view either. And I'm sure that they probably never think of that when they concede those games, knowing that there's 3 more ends of television time potentially for me here if I stay out here. So I think it's just something that needs to be rethought. And it's the difficulty that curling has had with many things, is separating the difference between the high performance level of the sport and the recreational level of the sport. And it's to some degree to do with the way the Breyer Scotties have been, kind of all blends together. And there's been need for a long time for some distinct lines to be drawn, just like every other sport that exists. And I thought the Olympics and then the Grand Slam would have made that far clearer than it is today. But it's not to the benefit of anybody, in my opinion, to have it all blurred.
Okay, let's whip along. I love this email that we got from Kent Cronin. Hey, guys, I continue to enjoy your podcast. Please keep up the good work. I love the players' interviews. Here's some questions I would love if you could answer them. I'm guessing, Kev, before I give you this question, that Ben Hebert would be broke because it says, are there fines for swearing if the game is on TV and the player is mic'd? I think Jonathan sent us an email that there is. Is it $250, Kevin, that you get fined, and then $500 after that, and for every time fall after that if you keep swearing?
Yeah, I don't think it's standard throughout all the different events. I think Jonathan probably sent from the Grand Slam point of view. I'm not exactly sure of how it all goes. I haven't played for a while. But in my day, yes, there was fines. There still is today. And Ben Hebert has definitely been fined. I know that for an absolute fact. He'll likely get fined his next game he plays. And he hasn't even played that game yet. So,
right.
and one more of your teammates, Kevin, that's been fined, I can attest to, is John Morris.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, Johnny Mo. But yeah, there are fines, and fines are important. And you know what, though? The person in charge of sound, Andrew Stokely, does a lot of work with Sportsnet. He's in charge of audio in the truck, and they can help a lot by knowing the game. Andrew's a curler. It's important to have a curler as a sound guy because they can shut those mics off, especially on people like Benny. And, you know, something's coming if things don't work out right. They can save the day on that. So, yes, there's a lot more swearing goes on the ice than what we hear, of course, in television land because the sound people in the truck are so good at their job. And sometimes it sneaks through, and that's sports. And, you know, it's unfortunate. But in a high energy and high pressure situation, sometimes things come out that you don't want to, and it happens, and sometimes it gets across the airwaves, but not very often. It's pretty good.
If I was Ben Hebert, before the start of the event, knowing I got a potty mouth, it's $250 for swearing. I would go in and just drop a check off for $2,250 and say, okay, I'm going to do it about 10 times, Kev. Okay, here's the cash. Okay, just pay. Maybe I can get a deal. Can I get a deal if I pay up front?
Except according to Jonathan and the Grand Slam, that's the first offense. The second one is $500.
Yeah, half a Gino. Okay. Yeah. Okay, give him $5,000, Benny, each event. You'll be okay. Let her fly. Second question from Kent. There seems to be a habit of after a shot, the players in the house on the same team as the ones who just shot will raise their arms or sticks up in acknowledgement. I know that. Yeah, way to go. I can see doing this on a shot that works well, but why is it done on shots that don't work out well, Kevin? That's true. I see that, you know, the guy, he totally missed the shot. The players sweep and then they raise their arms like they just won the gold medal. What's up with that?
Well, they raise the broom in acknowledgement that probably in that case, it's a threw it pretty well, something like that. It wasn't a complete blunder, but not always do the shots work out. But I think it's more of a message from skip to thrower that usually in my case, if I did that, that meant that the person threw it right up the broom and I just, you know, something happened or I gave the wrong ice or whatever the case may be. But you want to acknowledge the player that, hey, that was actually a good throw.
Yeah, it means that it's okay. I still love you.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Yeah, you're still on the team, Jim. Okay, yeah. Number three, you're tied in the eighth with hammer, and you have an easy shot to either blank or score one. What do you do?
I think there's a basic rule in the sport of curling. When given the option of scoring one or blanking the end, you will choose to blank the end to keep the hammer. You never want to take one unless you have to, unless it's the last end and score is tied, because your advantage, your opportunity to score is when you've got last rock. And as soon as you take that single point, and I know there's this philosophy about odd ends and even ends, but I think when it gets right down to it, the most important thing is to maintain control, and that's to keep the hammer.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, hold on to that hammer. We have seen it, though, Jim. That was a good question by Kent, because we have seen some teams that will take a point in eight to go one up, playing nine, giving up the hammer. I wouldn't do it, and not many teams would do it, but good question to ask, because I have seen it lately done a couple of times. But I think, to Warren's point, hang on to that hammer.
Are you allowed to start sweeping behind a rock before the rock is moving? So is that question, Warren, meaning you're the skip down watching a stone being delivered? They're trying to move out a stone. Can you sweep that rock? Is that what they mean, Warren? Can you sweep it before it's moving? Is that what that question is?
I think they're talking about a rock in the house that's going to potentially be removed with the stone that's coming down. And can you start sweeping it before contact is made? And the answer is no. And I know this happens behind the tee line where the rights are pretty much equal, except the playing side does have the first right to get next to the stone. But basically, if there's a rock coming down, it's going to strike a rock behind the tee line, and you want to start, quote, warming up the ice, that's supposedly not supposed to happen. You're not supposed to start sweeping until the stone starts to move. And I know that's done quite often, and it's back the old story of the situation behind the tee line at the playing end where the rights of the sweepers or the teams become kind of equal, where each team can have one person that can sweep behind the tee line. And I know back in my day, this was a common thing that would happen. So your rock's coming down the ice and it's maybe a little fast. And so your skip, and mine weighing 270 pounds, would just stand on the tee line until the rock got there. So the other guy couldn't start the sweeper, couldn't warm it up. And it goes back to the old story again. This is another rule, I believe, the sweeping behind the tee line that maybe by the opponent should have been taken out a long time ago. I don't really see the need for it. And it's the only time in the sport of curling where you can actually do anything to possibly prohibit your opponent from succeeding. So, but back to answer Kent's question, you can't start sweeping the rock before it starts to move.
Kevin, why don't we just be allowed to sweep any rock anywhere at any time? How about that?
And you got to have your shoulder pads and your helmet on. And yeah, that's one part of the game where it does get exciting when the rock is coming to the tee line and the other team wants to get on that thing to carry it as far as possible. So, of course, the other team is going to block them until the last second. And you get some good cross-checks going. And over the years, there's been lots of fun in that regard. So that's kind of the only body contact part of our sport, really.
I'll tell you what, if that was allowed, you're allowed tackling in curling? If they had allowed tackling in curling? I think Warren's a little feisty, Kev. Okay, I wouldn't want to get in his way. Okay, he's going to take you to old football player.
I've always said if you want to make curling really exciting is make the area between the hog lines open territory. And each team has two people out there, and the object of one team is to stop the other from trying to interfere with your stone.
That'd be great. Thanks a lot, Kent, for those questions. We really appreciate them. We really appreciate all your emails. Very good, boys. When we come back, we've got our guest, Erin Flowers, who's going to come on and tell us about a great program that Goldline, she's the president of that company, that Goldline is involved in. So stick around. We have talked about this before in mainstream sports. You've heard it all the time about what they're doing, about racialized people in sports, in football, basketball, baseball, hockey. We've heard about initiatives that they're taking and the awareness. We've got to give those sports kudos for developing awareness. And I've got to admit, I'm guilty about not thinking about curling when it came to this. Erin Flowers is the president of Goldline. It's a curling company, the biggest in the world. I read a couple of things yesterday that your company put out, Erin. And like I say, I just thought curling was immune to this thing. And I'm guilty as charged for not considering that there is a problem with this, with racism and the systemic problem that it's been. And we really want to welcome to the show and congratulate you on this initiative, Erin, that you guys are taking. Welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Oh, thank you.
Let me just read, Erin, what you guys put out, your company put out, and what you're saying about this. The program is called United We Curl, and it's an initiative developed by Goldline in continuation of our ongoing commitment to fight systemic racism and promote inclusion in our sport. This follows directly from the statement we released in the summer of 2020 outlining our solidarity with Black Lives Matter and pledge to open up curling for racialized persons and people who identify as belonging to communities pushed to the margins in our society. We're committed to addressing inequalities in curling, especially for those who do not feel safe in our curling clubs. By opening up those spaces, curling can truly meet curling's vision of a fully inclusive and diverse sport. Talk about that, Erin, how this all came together.
Yeah, it's definitely a different space for our company, for I believe the industry. And I think globally, people became more and more aware of the issue of race in maybe general, I would say, and then also in sport. And I think as a company, I guess a little over a year ago, just really sat down with ourselves individually. And then we also ended up just meeting as a team and recognizing that we really truly haven't done enough. You read the statement, and that's we stand by that. And I'm very grateful for two business partners that we all align in this space. And as an ownership group, we just really set out to make a change and committed to moving forward, kind of no matter what. I think it's almost, if I'm really honest, it's become a bit of a joke amongst people until this season as to how white curling is. And it's kind of, myself, I've jokingly said how vanilla my industry is, and I don't think anymore there's nothing funny about it. And I think that I had to really look at myself, and I know that Kevin himself knows a bit of my own story of having a Black son and recognizing that there's a real duality to his experience in curling, and it has been nothing short of incredible. He has been very well, the curling community have been unbelievably kind to him. And in the same breath, I've never seen more racism that he's experienced than in the curling clubs. And as hard as that's been to be front row seats as his adopted, I've adopted him, I think for me, I have to do something about this. He is not welcome the same way I am, strictly due to his skin color, in the sport that I would die on a sword for. So what are we going to do? Sorry, that's a little heavy, but that's kind of where I'm coming from.
No, that's good. People need to know it. As I say, when I launched into reading your statements yesterday, I said, my God, this is, why would they be immune to this thing? Unfortunately, as you say, this thing happens, and you get great response from the curling community, but also some experiences that we're really trying to get rid of. The program itself, Erin, tell us about the curling broom or the brushes that you're talking about was the first part of this initiative that you guys looked at.
Yeah, I think I couldn't, I just, the timing of having a dear friend, but also Dr. Richard Norman kind of coming on board with our company as an advisor in this space was absolutely key to us moving forward in this initiative. So last year, we made the statement, Rich is working with us. We started doing a couple Instagram lives, and out of that came discussions with the racialized community in curling. And I think out of that came lived experiences, and out of that comes awareness. And suddenly we as a company are going, what are we going to do here in terms of something moving forward that shows that this truly is a value, and we aren't going to just keep our, like, our words won't be hollow. And so we, you know, just a couple of people that really I have had the honor of working with is Andrew Paris, Deborah Martin, and Graydon Yee Lewison. And these three designers from racialized communities, it just came to the forefront. And I have to say, it was last fall, I was wondering, what can we do as a company to really make it public that this is something that we value? And I was reading articles all over about big, small, micro-sized companies making changes and making considerable change. And basically, the curling brush is probably the most prominent product on the scene. I mean, other than your actual uniforms. And I just thought to myself, what if we did something with these three people that have really changed us as a company? And they designed, and we gave full creative freedom to them to do whatever they wanted that would represent their community and their message. And to be honest, I wasn't like, that these three were it. They were the people. And I think that's kind of how it started. And then we ended up saying, okay, this is one initiative of many. What are we going to call this? And Andrew Paris is a Canadian curler out of Truro, Nova Scotia. And he actually, it was a bit of a collaboration, but he did come up with United We Curl. And then we ran with that as our kind of parent initiative. And one of the projects in that initiative is the brush designs.
You talk about Dr. Richard, who's on your board, and you, as you say, was extremely helpful. His topic up for his PhD back in January 2020 was on diversity in curling. And your statement, or your company statement, was his research was fresh, but at the same time, painfully accurate. Can you give us a little synopsis of that, of his take on the whole thing?
Yeah. Rich's story is pretty powerful. In fact, Rich wouldn't have probably written his dissertation on diversity in curling if it wasn't for him and I having a long night in Toronto after several pints. And I made him promise me he'd come to a Bontspiel after my travel season was over. And he said, I'm in. And it's I don't want to speak for him, but he had a weekend that he'll, you know, caused him to see everything incredible about our sport, and continued as he left and throughout the weekend to still feel like an other amongst everything profound that he experienced. So I think Rich's story himself is incredible, but I think his research, you know, it is painfully accurate. It is the history of curling doesn't lend itself well to inclusivity. And I think as I've delved deep into learning and just sitting like, and I say sitting back, not without, I was in an educate me and listening mode for a lot of this past year and will continue. But I think it is. I look at not everybody's experience is mine. Not everyone's experience when I'm on 89% of my phone calls in curling is that of a person in a racialized community when they first walk into a curling club. And I think it's been that way historically. And Rich's, I mean, his PhD is, or sorry, his dissertation is obviously rather lengthy, as they are. And if you read through this, it's quite a powerful layout that his approach he took. And I actually was honored to be there the day he became a doctor, and to hear these other profs in a room at the University of Waterloo, you know, delve deep into curling was I felt like I wanted to have a summit around this. It was one of the most what I thought was going to be, you know, a day to go and support my friend because it was an incredible moment, was a real day for curling, was what I felt in the end.
Tell us about Goldline. What's happening equipment-wise? What's the biggest change that you've seen in the last little while? How's business during COVID? Bring us up to speed.
I believe I can actually say that Gold Line Curling has survived a pandemic. It's our first. I'm not sure how you know, it's been the roller coaster that everyone's experienced. And just when you think you're having the worst day of your life, you don't think it's you're not alone in small business. I think everyone in Canada, you know, it's an understatement to say we took a hit, but couldn't be more proud of our team. I have two business partners, Pete Townsend and Andrew Brett, who the three of us, we've never been tighter, and it's not for having not gone through hell, but we've made it. We out of the gate last year in March of 2020, and recognizing that this wasn't just a couple weeks, and I wasn't going to hang tight at home while the women's worlds didn't happen, as I was on my way to Prince George. And I believe we took the opportunity. We made some hard decisions out of the gate that were very hard, and it will continue to be the most difficult year of our careers. But we also did make hard decisions out of the gate, which we're now being rewarded for in terms of being able to get through this. And rec sport as a whole took such a hard hit, and curling is obviously in that. And I think where we're coming from now is, I've often said it, anyone who's ever had curling on their bucket list and lost the ability to have any type of experience in the last 16 months, I want to make sure those people will get on the ice this coming season. Like, if you've ever wanted to curl, we're going to make sure that we're a part of the industry that helps you get try this sport.
That's me. I'm right there. I'm your guy. Yeah, I'm your guy.
Oh, no, no.
There are some exceptions, I believe. Yes.
Well, Aaron, thanks a lot for coming on today. And obviously, you and I go back a long time. And even with your dad, Doug, I don't know, I've been doing business with the Gold Line family and the company for, God, I guess since the late 80s, for goodness sakes. It wasn't with your grandpa, Ed, though. I didn't do any work with Ed, but I did with Doug, and now, of course, with you, Andrew, and Pete. But I want to go back to United We Curl, because that's a terrific initiative. I would love to hear your, because it's been about a year now, just the responses of two different groups. That would be the fans and curlers, recreational curlers, but then also the top curlers in this initiative. I see so much social media when it comes to the top players in our game. They're very proud of this initiative that you've went with. And I'd like to hear your what you hear and what you talk to as far as fans and top curlers, and not just in Canada, but around the world as well.
Yeah, I'm very proud, and I think calling out the really a couple teams that really stood up were Rachel Holman's team, Brendan Botcher's team, Jason Gunlinson's team. And there was some great representation in the U.S. as well, with Chase Sinnott and Monica Walker. Now, if I'm really honest, we're seeing some people use their platform. And I think there's room to grow there. And I'm excited about that coming into a season where you'll have more people on the ice talking about a hard conversation. And I think when I talk to my friends in the BIPOC community and racialized communities in curling and outside of it, when you kind of ask them what you can do as someone, you know, in a privileged position, they just say, can you keep talking about race in your sport, Aaron? Can you just keep talking about it? And I think that we all know it's not a comfortable conversation. I mean, all of us could talk all day and night about curling products, you know, sweeping events, all kinds of stuff. But when it comes to talking about race, it's just not a comfortable conversation. So these curlers who have stepped up and stepped out, I'm so grateful to be associated with them.
Yeah, you know, I really think it is something that's important to talk about. Because, you know, in Canada, of course, that's from my point of view. Born in a small town in Alberta and in the middle of a farming community. So where I come from, of course, it's a little two-sheeter and you just grew up traditionally in our sport. That's just the way it is. But, you know, Warren and I have talked about in growing our sport. Well, our sport can grow like crazy if we allow it to. And I think this is a terrific part of it. I do, as you know, Aaron, quite a lot of teaching in the States. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the U.S. As far as growth, maybe a little bit different than Canada. It seems to be different when I walk into clubs. The traditional curler in Canada and the traditional curler in the States tends to be kind of different. The average age is certainly different, much younger in the U.S. than in Canada, and seems to be more diverse in the U.S. than in Canada. Do you find the same, or am I just sort of maybe reading more into it?
No, I find the same. I've often come back from any business trip in the U.S. or anytime I'm in the U.S. I lived in Atlanta, Georgia for almost 5 years in a former life and career. And I often come back when it comes specific to curling and say, us Canadians have so much to learn about what they're doing in the U.S. Obviously, some exciting stuff is happening down there. And part of it is because of their ability to turn the switch back on a bit faster than us with COVID. They are, if you have heard about what's going on in the Southern Curling, Southern California and Curling LA, it's just, to me, that excites me almost more than anything going on right now, because it's the future of curling. And I do believe that the U.S. Are on the right track. And I actually love what they're doing from the top as well at the USCA. They did put out a statement as a larger, you know, sporting organization, you know, did call out the issue of race. And I do believe that is going to be something that does, you know, separate them a bit in the right way of going on a track that to me is the future of curling. You know, I've been reading a lot and doing a lot of work in the area of race and sport. And they've said, if your CEO can't become your CDO, your chief diversity officer, it has to start from the top. And so I think the States is doing things to create the true inclusivity of our sport right from the top.
Aaron, you talked about your son and the curling community being so great. I mean, one of the great attractions to curling, certainly for me and for many, many people at all levels, is how grassroots it is, how down to earth the curling community is, how friendly, how fun, you know, everything from the curling itself to socializing and partying and stuff like that. You had talked about your son had experienced racism. Can you give us an example of what happened there? You talked both about him having a fantastic experience and being embraced by it, but at the same time, the cold reality of racism that happened. Can you give us an example of what did happen that made everyone look up and go, whoa, we got a problem here?
Sometimes I wish I could interview my friend that was with me this day as well, because I think that she's had a couple powerful moments when it comes to the reality of, you know, not being white. And I think that the curling club is, I do want to make sure that it's mentioned how incredible the curling community have been to Draylen since he has been, oh gosh, Kevin, I think the first time you met him might've been when he was four. Like, I've known him for years. So I think, when I think back to how long, he's now 21, but he started curling when he first moved here when he was 16 years old from Atlanta. And one thing that was notable to me was he tried a lot of different sports. And the only sport he mentioned to me that he knew he noticed he was black was in curling. And it was just an observation. This kid loves life and just tries everything. But I was actually dropping off an order to a curling club. And I had my hands full of boxes, and so did my son right behind me. And a gentleman, a middle-aged white gentleman, held the door for me as he noticed my hands were full. And Draylen, whose hands were equally as full, he just let the door slam on his face. And I said to him, I said, excuse me, he's with me. Like, can you open the door for him? And his exact response was, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize he was with you. And, you know, as his mom, I tend to have an almost visceral response to this. And I dropped my boxes and I said, he's not just with me. He deserved to have the door held for him. And this guy just looked at me and kind of shrugged off like, well, you know, I didn't know he was even at the club. I didn't realize he was with the club. And I was like, everything you're saying, sir, is not helping your cause. So I think at the end of the day, you know, here's my kid holding gold line boxes that are matching mine. And I just, that was one moment. I've often said my storyline in this space is having a black son who, until people realize he's with me, he's treated differently. And that is in the curling space.
Let's talk a bit about goal line in the curling business, because unlike Kevin, I did know your grandfather.
Of course you did.
Of course.
Yeah. Interesting enough, I mean, goal line goes back to 1967. And interesting enough, I'm quite a bit younger than your grandfather, but nevertheless, we were in the same business. Really, at the same time, he was establishing it, I was getting into it, and we both actually represented Midwestern Broom, myself in Alberta and of course in Ontario. And always interesting that Gold Line had its own line of corn brooms. I remember one in particular called the Otter that was their broom, but it was actually made by Midwestern. So there was a connection. And of course, your father, Doug, him and I worked together with the Briar, and and merchandising for a 10-year period, I think, from about 1990 till 2000. So I've known your family in the curling business for many, many years, and both Kevin and I have been in the equipment business, so we are familiar with it. Tell me something today. What exactly is Gold Line's focus today? You're into equipment that's primarily being used by the players. Are you still in rink equipment as well? Or what exactly are you guys selling these days at Gold Line?
Yeah, I do. It's neat to hear you talk about my grandfather, because I think he would be very excited that I'm on a podcast with you right now. Yeah, we are in the equipment business, Gold Line, and our focus is grassroots curling. And absolutely, we make our product to perform at every level. But the recreational curler is truly who Gold Line is set up for. And I think that grassroots and the growth of this game is really Andrew, Pete, and I's future. So grassroots is who we are. We have quite an extensive line of product, everything from everything you would use to curl. We are really big on getting curling shoes to us are a part of equipment. So we're really jumping headfirst into the rental game. And, you know, the likes of Curling LA and other curling clubs globally have really adopted the rental corporate side of the game and the ability to try curling. And I think that's exciting to us. Actually, another club that's doing a phenomenal job is Kelowna. Jock Tyer just puts in relentless hours of making sure that that rental program runs seamlessly. But yeah, we are an equipment business, and we really, really love that the recreational curler can come to us and have such a great experience up to the elite curler.
Aaron, does Gold Line, are they a manufacturer, for example, of curling brooms?
Absolutely. Yep. We manufacture all our own product when it comes to equipment.
Yeah. So walk us through that process. What, how do you make a broom? How's that all work?
Oh gosh. The birth of the broom. Okay. Well,
asking the president, how do we make this thing?
Yeah. Well, if I tell you that, I'd have to kill you. Yeah. No, I'm kidding. It was corn brooms. Yeah, thankfully we've grown from those days. But I mean, I have grown up in this business. There is there's an argument out there that I was possibly conceived in a briar patch. I've been around here for a long time, so I think that when it comes to the brush, it's obviously this is an evolving space in curling. It has come very far, and in fact, come so far to become controversial, which I think is a compliment to the sport in many ways, which a lot of people look at as something negative. But the Olympics put us on the map. And with that being said, we, you know, have always been in the spirit of the game and just wanting to make product that represents that spirit. And, you know, obviously the evolution of the curling brush isn't just Gold Line. This whole we're not the only ones in this game, and this industry has a few of us, which makes it all the more exciting as well. And I think synthetic came out, and that obviously changed the game. There was the brownie. I mean, Warren, you, I'm sure, could give the timeline even better than myself. But here we are now with a couple of us out there with, you know, everything from the recreational level pad where you can put different materials on it to the elite level where we have an approval system, which is great. We all follow our guidelines and we all have something that hopefully people want.
It's interesting looking at the equipment aspect, and this goes back to something I've always had in my mind. There's really no standard set for anything. I've always been in the opinion that sliders, grippers, brooms, design, anything that touches the ice should have a standard that the manufacturer has to make, but it really doesn't. And even things like the corn broom, which has long been gone, it's not banned. I've got a dozen corn brooms here. I could break one out and take it on the ice, and within an end, the game would become unplayable. I guess, from your opinion, do you think there's a need that standards be developed for any product that goes on the ice? Is that something that should happen?
I'm not sure if there's a standard needed for every product on the ice. I think people police themselves in this sport in a way that's quite respectful when it comes to club curling. I think if I came out to my Wednesday night league with a corn broom, I would be the talk of the town, but I don't think, also that is legit exhausting compared to sweeping now. I do think obviously the whole world of sweeping has, you know, it's an analysis unto itself when it comes to technique combined with a product is something that as a company, we really drill down into an area of equipment. We can't, it's very hard for us to know how sometimes someone will use this product that could be detrimental to the sport. I don't know if that's, maybe that's too strong of a word. But obviously, we have these specs when it comes to how we make product moving forward when it comes specific to the brush. I'm not sure if that's necessary for shoes or this other, you know, you mentioned grippers as well. Gloves is another part of equipment, but obviously that's tough to get to a level of performance that could have an advantage. I think it's advantage that we're concerned about.
Well, I think also damage. I mean, a slider, depending upon what it's made out of, could in fact cause damage to the ice. A gripper, if it's not made of the right material, could again cause shedding. That's going to be a nightmare. So I think, you know, as we sit today, and I suggest that at club level, there's not a need to be that concerned. But I think at the top level of the sport, like most sports, if you take a look at golf, everything that's going to be used has to be inspected, has to be ensured that it has the standard of the sport attached to it, and we really don't have that existing in any aspect of curling, except for the broom pads, I guess, for the top couple. That's the one thing that does have a standard to it. Yet, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe as far as recreational curling, you can still pretty much, from a brushing point of view, use whatever you like. Can you not?
Yeah, it's yes, you're correct, Warren. I think that clubs can mandate certain leagues in certain areas, and I know for my club, certain leagues is pretty open, but you know, if you have a competitive league, they want to make sure that they've even the playing field. And I did mention, I do find that people do police themselves in the area of brushes at this point. You're right when it comes to shoes and, you know, damaging the ice. And I don't know who I'm more terrified in the curling industry than upsetting an ice maker. So if we run our product by them when it comes to ice damage and they give us their approval, that's enough for us when it comes to shoes and grippers. If we're going to make a product that damages ice, then we're not going to have them on side. And that just seems like an awful idea.
Aaron, you're probably going to stay away from the old broom ball, Walchuk and Millard Evans broom ball shoe idea back in the day.
That does go back. Yes. No, I think shoes are definitely Teflon. I mean, we're not getting rid of Teflon anytime soon. The quarter inch Teflon, I think, is the industry standard for, and it's a clean product that, as I mentioned, your ice maker approved. And I think that the whole world of shoes has also evolved. And I love that it's just looking, you know, our company has decided that looking athletic is actually a part of the artistic graphic and creativity that we want to kind of explore as a company. We have people come in with a pair of custom Nike shoes they've bought from SportCheck, and they walk into our store and go, oh, wait, hold on. You guys already have what I want on the shelf. So I don't need to actually get these custom made with quarter inch Teflon. I love that that's something that we run into is people think our product is athletic enough that they don't have to go out and buy a Nike or an Adidas shoe, because part of, you know, of course, everybody loves Adidas and Nikes, but what they don't recognize is when they walk into the arena or their club, sorry, not an arena, they freeze and they come back and they're like, oh no, we forgot about the fact that we didn't think about insulation when we bought a cross trainer.
I know this is getting a little sideways, but I get a lot of people, obviously, as you know, coming in the store to get a pair of custom shoes done. But I try to warn them a lot about the heat from your feet when you're working hard. You know, your feet get hot, they sweat. But a pair of like Nikes or Adidas, normal running shoes, they don't worry about heat going through to the ground or the grass or the pavement. But in curling, it's really detrimental to the ice. And this is to Warren's point of damaging the ice, because if your feet are hot, especially on the gripper shoe, that heat goes right to the ice and you get those flat spots. And the only thing that when I do shoes for people that are custom made, I try to, you know, let them know to get a reflective insole in them to keep that heat from hitting the ice. How big of a deal is that? Because your shoes all come with some sort of a insulation to keep the heat from hitting the ice.
Absolutely. And I think it's honestly, it's the difference between we make a curling shoe. We have thought through everything from A to Z as to why this is made for the sport of curling. And, you know, I have a closet full of, you know, lovely looking Nikes and Adidas, but I'm never going to wear them on the ice because I know that they haven't been designed for the sport of curling. And I, to your point, there's a lot of work and design and development in the midsole of a curling shoe. And that is a big part when it comes to everything from support to transferring heat to the ice. I also think that, you know, when you get into the elite level playing field, they'd redefine the sport in a totally different area. And they can, the balance alone, their balance is incredible. And if you take a regular pair of Nikes as well, they're not balanced appropriately for curling. So the everyday Joe that goes out, they're a little more frustrated with even learning the game.
You guys spend a lot of your time in the summertime yourself, your family, you and your partner, Chris and Dre, and of course, Doug, up in Port Elgin. And I know that isn't Doug pretty involved in the 2022 Tankard being housed in Port Elgin?
Yes, he is. My father went and retired and we bought the business and got hit with a lovely global pandemic, which was fun to run. And then Doug's up here golfing and chairing curling events coming to town. So I think that, Doug's been such a great supporter of the sport. And he is chairing the 2022 Port Elgin, or Soggy Shores Tankard, I believe it's called, because there's a community here. So he's very excited about it. If Doug's not talking about it, we have to check his pulse, actually, at this point.
That's great. That's great. I love when you said, Aaron, that, I mean, this is a very serious topic, you know, this United We Curl and racism and, you know, and social injustice that a lot of people are experiencing these days, and very serious. And I love when you said, well, when we really got down to the bottom, it was after we had several pints. That's I love that about curling. Yeah, I love that.
There's some irony to that, though, Jim. Today is I'm actually 7 years sober today. So that was a while ago. There is another aspect to, I gave it my best efforts for years and I did give it a good go.
Yeah. You ran out of beer tickets, did you?
I ran out of tickets. Yeah, that was the last day. But yeah, just to comment on the, just really quick to sum up United We Curl, I do believe that one thing as a community we can do is truly listen to some of the lived experiences of the racialized community in our sport. And that's really what's changed us as a company, is listening to the lived experience of someone else walking into a curling club.
Congratulations on the 7 years, Aaron. I'll be 12 years clean and sober in August.
Oh, wow. Well done, Jim. Nice. This last year, I think I might have earned it.
Yeah. No kidding.
It got pretty real there. Yeah.
Thanks a lot. And good luck. Those of us at Inside Curling, whatever we can do to help, I know Kevin and Warren and myself would do whatever works for you guys. So,
thank you. Well, thank you for having me today.
You better.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, Aaron.
Okay, well, another great show, boys. As we move through the summer, lots of stuff to talk about. Kevin, by the way, you had talked about watching, you went to the Masters in 2001. I want to say either Tiger or Vijay Singh won that year.
It was the Tiger Slam.
Oh, it was that year? Okay. I went to the par three competition on the Wednesday. And at that time, Nicklaus, Gary Player, and Arnold Palmer were grouped together. And it was just crazy that you got to see these guys. I followed them on that par three, and it's always held up, right? You got to wait to hit your shot. They were talking, Kev and Warren, about how many holes in one they've had. I've had two. I've played golf my whole life. I've had two. I know guys who have had multiple, five, six. Between the three of them, they've had over 100 holes in one. How's that? How's that? So you're right, Warren. There's no hope for us. Thanks a lot, everyone, for listening to the show. We really appreciate it. That's us. We're reaching out to curling clubs all over the world and inviting them to contact us for a Zoom call. We did one a couple weeks ago with a club out of Kentucky. July 12th is when we're doing our next one. So we'll be doing that. Check it out. Listen to it. And if you'd like us to do it, get a hold of us. It's something that we do for about an hour. And we do it for clubs, you know, for your board of directors or your membership in general. The producers of the show, thanks a lot, Warren Hansen and Amal Delic. who's mixed and does the sound design. Jonathan, thank you, Jonathan. By the way, Amal had his baby. We had mentioned it on the last show. So his life won't change much, Kev. No, he'll be fine. Congratulations. Andrew Holland, thank you for your additional support. We'd also like to extend a big thank you to Rod Paulson. He's been fantastic. His company is In-House Strategies, and he handles all our stuff on the Facebook page. Boys, that's it for this show. We're back next week. Kev, who's our guest? You've lined someone else up again.
Yeah, you know what? Going into the summer, and of course, with such a big fall coming into the Olympic Games, thought we'd probably talk to Pete Stetsky, and that's the fella who's trying to get the Players Association up and running again. And I think it's a really important job, and I want to hear how they're doing and where they're at. So Pete Stetsky will be on our show next week.
Thanks a lot, Warren. You have yourself a good week. Kevin, you as well. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Inside Curling.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks, Jim.
You're welcome, fellas.